Good evening. This evening we have William Seal, who is historian of the White House and who has written the definitive work, The President's House, that is going to come out in a revised edition. When will it come out? In a year
about,
or so?
About a year.
Uh-huh. And he's going to talk to us tonight using slides of the White House and talk about the public image of the President and of the White House and how it is the image has been a thought on the minds of the presidents and sometimes of their wives as well, of the White House, the ways in which they want to use it to further the image of the president. And William, do you want to start with your slides?
Sure.
And then what we'll do is after we finish them, then we'll take questions from both the University of California students and the ones at Towson.
Well, I brought a lot of them, but I'll go through them as fast as I can. The points I want
to—there's
some points I want to make about the White House. You know, we've all been exposed to old houses and historic buildings and things like this. The White House is a very special building, and it was built as a symbolic building and built to be that way. There's not a whole lot left of it except the outside stone walls that you see, and they were rebuilt 35 years after the house was finished, after it was burned by the British, as I'll tell you. But the house was conceived in a time of kings and kingdoms and palaces, and Versailles was still at its heyday, and as the walls rose, Versailles fell. In fact, the French Revolution, it began with the beginning of the violent part with the Bastille, began just a few months after George Washington was inaugurated as President of the United States under the new Constitution. So Washington, in planning this, really, he never envisioned himself as a king. But many people did. Many people would like for him to have been one. And those who were more cynical would, because he didn't have any children and wasn't going to have any. But the mold of the presidency is descended from kings. And it there's no other way it could have been, because that's what everything was in those days. And so when they came to build a city, which, if I could have the first slide, was Washington. Here's Washington. You're looking from the green room into the east room. I have to have a little light. I don't want everyone to go to sleep right away. Do you have a match, Martha? With all this technology? This painting is the first and really last state portrait ever ordered for the United States. Pause over it a second and see the pose. Now, a president would not present himself that way today. Here it's painted as though he is a king with his but with the American symbol. I'm sorry, it's the one before.
Yeah.
It's like a state portrait in Europe of a king. He's standing. He's in his black velvet suit that he received in, with his silver dress sword, which he kept on one hand, and the other hand behind him, so no one would try to shake hands. It was considered rude. And the whole conception of Washington's circle and court at the beginning was a kingly thing, and based on what George III did in England. It didn't last long, and Jefferson's revolution was against that sort of thing, and it was a sort of revolution. But to get to the White House, the White House came from George Washington and his wish. He wished not only for a presidential palace, as they called it, but a city in the European sense. It would be the capital. It would be new, it would be civic, governmental, and it would become the economic center of the United States. In those days, going up the Potomac, which way back in the 18th century these people had planned, doing away with some rock outcroppings and so forth would take you to the Ohio River at Pittsburgh, and then back into the interior where there was all this rich land and so forth. This city was planted right on the site of that. And Washington's vision was great, as we'll see in the next picture, which is a plan, a print of a plan that was done at the time in 1792 by Pierre Charles L'Enfant. L'Enfant was a Frenchman who came to America with the volunteers gotten up by the playwright Beaumarchais, wrote The Marriage of Figaro, and he got up companies to come to the United States, or to the colonies, and help in the revolution. L'Enfant was one of these people. I've traced him in France. It's dead end streets all along. His parents worked for the French court. His mother had a pension from the Queen of Louis XV, and they were very close to the court. And he considered Washington a king, and that he didn't have to deal with anyone but the king. But he laid out this city plan here that was incredible, incredibly huge, and in the most modern city planning of France at the time and in Europe. And it was presented. Washington liked it. Jefferson and Madison hated it because they didn't want anything that august and in the image of Europe. But that's the budding republicanism in the 1790s. The Federalist was represented by Washington, loved it. The city was laid out. And you see in this plan, right straight up here, is the White House, and then the Mall to your left, or right, I'm sorry, and the Capitol. And it was very elaborate. There were fountains planned. The Capitol was to perch where it is now, toward the edge, and a creek was diverted under it and was to shoot out from under it and fall in a cascade of 40 feet down into a rivulet or a little creek that ran to the river. And you would communicate through the city in sailboats and be given muddy roads of the time. And the vast avenues that had the city's a grid plan like this, graph paper, with these shortcut avenues run through it that are ceremonial. The big avenue, Pennsylvania Avenue, which connects the Capitol to the palace, it was called, was where the Congress was to march after with the bills to personally present them to the king, as the various estates did in Europe. It was all laid out, and the palace was begun. The foundations were dug. It was a building four times the size of the White House, more like the National Gallery of Art, and it was much taller than the present building, about 25 feet taller, if you can imagine. And when I tell you that the White House was the biggest house in this country till probably 1870, 75, in ground plan, it was quite a place they had in mind, four times that size. And the house was to be exactly placed where New York Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue crossed. As you can see, the avenues would have run through it. It makes kind of a shallow X. Well, L'Enfant didn't work out. He didn't get along with committees, and he wanted to deal just with Washington. It didn't work, and so he had to go. And so a lot of his plans were thrown out. The huge cellars of the palace were dug. Capitol was begun. So Washington is left to try to figure out how to get this city built and this house built while he's still in office. So no one, the enemies of it, will not stop it, because he's pulling the Capitol from, it was in New York, then it was in Philadelphia, and he's drawing it in the year 1800 to the Potomac. So they got to get going. Well, what did he have for precedent? What did he know? He'd never been anywhere except in the West Indies with his dying brother, and he had not traveled. He had read. This is a great plantation house called Mount Airy. This is a little picture. It's about this big, and it's in the Huntington, California. And that was the most palatial sort of thing Washington's generation knew, is houses like that. That's a dollhouse compared to what was later built. In Williamsburg, Virginia, where many of you have probably been, these are the public buildings built in the reign of William and Mary, or begun then. And the palace is this building over to this way, with the cupola on top. It's now reconstructed there in its original cellars. Washington knew that building well, so he would have known that as a house of a head of state, where it should live. But he worried a lot about it. Meanwhile, in New York, before he left, and then again in Philadelphia, the local citizens began to put up these palatial houses, hoping he would like them and stay. This is the one in New York. There are no good drawings of the one in Philadelphia, which was actually much more palatial. Washington would never enter either one of them, and they tried to trick him, and many his great friend, Mrs. Powell, tried to trick him into going into the one in Philadelphia many times, and he never would. He didn't want to make it important by his presence. He was very aware that he was worshipped almost like a god or a hero. This building seems to have caught his eye on a trip to the South. In those days, the presidents went on progresses. They would go on the carriage north, New England, and then they'd go south and meet their constituencies and all, and they'd be entertained. And So going south in 1792, he saw this building, almost certainly. And when L'Enfant left and he was back home, he began to be interested in it. It's in Charleston, South Carolina, at the corner of Meeting and Broad. It is a building that is a courthouse now, but it was always called the State House. Because it was built, it was a courthouse, and it was remodeled and expanded by local citizens in hopes that the state capitol would stay in Charleston when it had moved in the inlands into Columbia. Well, we don't know for sure, but Washington wrote down to Charleston and said, who was that builder I met that built the courthouse? And they recommended James Hoban. James Hoban was an Irishman. A rival architect called him a wild Irish boar. But he was from Kilkenny, and he was educated in Dublin in the Royal Dublin Society School under the architect Thomas Ivory. He came to America, was first in Philadelphia and then in Charleston. He is the hardest person to trace that I have ever tried to trace in my life. Through Ireland, Philadelphia, Charleston, you just can't associate him with anything but that building, circumstantially, that I just showed you. His house burned in 1833, and all of the papers in it were consumed. So there's very little left of James Hoban, except in the National Archives, building orders, nothing that says what he thought about anything. But he knew how to handle the great and powerful, and he headed to Philadelphia to meet Washington. Washington liked him a lot, and they got together and made a plan. Meanwhile, a competition was held, which was about as rigged as a competition ever has been in history. George Washington knew exactly who he was going to have, but have your competition if you will. So Hoban came up with this floor plan, which he actually drew in the commissioner's office here in Washington. Getting all kinds of favoritism. This is the plan you would see at the White House today. This is 1792. It won the competition because Washington made the final decision, and he just flipped through the rest. And so the competition drawings are hilarious. Some of them have draped thrones and throne rooms, and you never saw such concepts of capital. This is a house, and the fact that it was patterned on the house of the Duke of Leinster in Dublin meant a lot to Washington, as I said about Hoban and knowing how to handle the great and powerful. The Duke of Leinster's brother had fought in the American Revolution. He was captured at the Battle of King's Mountain and taken as a gentleman in those days' definition and put on house arrest at George Washington's cousin's house in Charleston. Lord Edward was a wild man, if ever there was one. He was later killed in the Revolution of 1798. He became a revolutionary, though he was a peer. And so Washington knew the family, and the Duke of Leinster's house. Duke of Leinster was always called the first gentleman of Ireland, and Washington, in his letters, says that the president is the first gentleman of the land and should live that way. So they patterned this building on that. Just to pause on it a little bit, to your left is the Grand Audience Room. That's where the bills were to have been brought down Pennsylvania Avenue and brought in and presented to the president, who would stand on a platform at the end of the room. You see how kingly. Then the entrance hall with a hole in the picture. They've had that restored, but I like the one with the hole in it. This is here. There's a back stair, K, or is it E? Taking my eye exam. But it went up a back stair. And then the row of parlors, just exactly like they are today. The oval room is the blue room. To the left is the green room. To the my left, to your left is the green room. To your right is the red room. Then over here this way, the state dining room, which today, and I'll show you later, they've knocked the partition out and there's no stair there, and it's all one big room. Then the family dining room on the corner, the usher's office or porter's lodge right here, the small room, little back stair, which Lincoln would make so much use of. That's it. It's interesting architecturally to comment on because it's so unlike a European house, and it's unlike Leinster House. Leinster House has little passages everywhere, little secret passages, and pieces of the wall that open up for service. Servants are never seen or anything. This is open like an American house. There are no secret areas, no little passages, no antechambers that would discriminate between social classes or rank. And there was so much form there. You know, you'd go to call on the Duke of Leinster. You would enter probably within an area that was an anteroom or a colonnade and stand there until allowed to enter. There was all this differentiation that this is a very open plan for that time and very American as well. Well, this is the plan actually built. George Washington enlarged it because the commissioners had reduced the size of the house greatly because they thought they wouldn't have enough stone, much less money. So the front of it, you'll recognize, this is the plan as adapted. The original one had a whole floor under that, like the courthouse in Charleston and like Leinster House. It's a very Irish way, they call them attached columns on there. It's a pretty practical way to build. Now this was, by October of 1793, this is what Washington approved as the White House. And the dimensions are the same. Those are the same walls that were built that you look at today, with some exceptions. So to build it in stone, as Washington required, nearly blew everyone's mind, because they're just, to begin with, was there that much stone? And second place, who was going to do it? It was very hard to get workmen to come to Washington to work. And so finally they went to Scotland. They sent a merchant, went to Scotland. They put up advertisements, would I ever love to have one, all around Edinburgh and all there. And a stone cutter appeared named Cullen Williamson, and he started the house. He was from the Highlands, and he had worked on this house. No, next, I'm sorry. This is called Moy House. It's a very plain Scottish Highland upper-level farmhouse, very erratic to go in. It's now burned, I'm sorry to say, but you used to go in and you go up steps here, steps there, stone walls, and then the rooms would be paneled, and it must have been as cold as it could be. And Cullen Williamson built that, and just about the time it was finished, the old lord, Ludovic Grant, who had hired him, died, and his nephew from London took over and brought in the Adam brothers, who finished the house as best they could. Well, Williamson was a competent stone cutter, but irascible and old, and he built the first story of the White House. He had to go, and they contacted, through a stone cutter in Philadelphia, stonemasons in Edinburgh, and a crew or lodge came over, and I was able to find them in the Scottish Rite Masonic records of where, when they had left and all that kind of stuff. They built the White House, those stone cutters. And Washington wanted it to be very elaborate. Well, these people had all worked for the Adam brothers in what's called Newtown in Edinburgh, where they were all invested in real estate, too. You built the front of the house, and then you sold it, and the people built the back like they wanted it to be. So it is a very fine work that they did, but they must have been amused at all that ornament because it was very out of style over there, but not for Washington. This is what's called the guilloche, or chain. It's carved under the windows in the stone. This shows it some years ago when all the paint was taken off, 40 layers of paint was taken off the White House. The front door is really virtuoso. When you go there and go out the north door, most people don't look back. Be sure and stop. That's 15 feet across the top. And it was all mucked up with paint 20 years ago, and now they've cleaned it and very lightly painted it. The stone came from downriver at a place called Aquia. It's a sandstone, and it's not good stone, but somehow it's still there. So that's the north door with all the symbolic, the roses and the it's not the American Beauty Rose, because that wasn't invented yet, but it's some sort of a rose that meant something to these people. And all the records are in the National Archives about the building. And the higher you went on the house, the more fish or beef you got per day, and whiskey, because you had spirits the higher you went. I don't know what the logic of that. The roofers did the best on that. But anyway, literally. And Washington again. This is the portrait that we looked at. It's the first artifact of the White House. It was one of the first things moved in, and it has been there ever since, except for one or two notable times.
Has it been in the same place?
No, it's moved around. Usually, first it was in the dining room, then it went into the blue room, then the red room, and then Mrs. Herbert Hoover in 1929 put it where it is today. And they found out recently that when it was put on, the walls are wood paneling, they didn't allow for wood behind the picture. So the picture was just mounted on the wall with no protection from the moisture and the stone behind it and concrete. So they've just taken that down and redone it. The first published view of the White House is this, which you'll recognize from Hoban's drawing. That's exactly what it looked like. A lot of the ornament, the American eagle and all that that L'Enfant had actually designed for other buildings, wasn't put there. But you see the swag over the door, and that's the way it was done. And the railing, the balustrade around the top. It had dormer windows. They don't show these. And servants' quarters were in the attic, but no servants ever lived in the attic. It was too high off the ground, and people were frightened to stay up there. The second tenant was Thomas Jefferson. The first was John Adams, who made very few changes. The house wasn't even finished when he moved in, and he made very few. They did attempt to do the ceremony of marching down Pennsylvania Avenue. And the gods were against it. It was the worst storm they'd seen in Washington in a long time. And it was muddy, and they were supposed to be in nice carriages, and they had to borrow hacks from Baltimore and places like that because the city was so unoccupied, stumps everywhere. And they went and got to the White House, and not only were they wet, soaked, miserable, the East Room wasn't finished, and they crowded in the entrance hall, and then they didn't like the food and drink. And that seems to have been the main thing. The Congress never got over how bad the food was. Because Adams was so tight, they were used to the Washingtons, who just were lavish entertainers. And as Mrs. Adams says, General Washington was a rich man. We're not. Jefferson lived in the house like this. The architect Benjamin Henry Latrobe did this sketch. And you see the plan, which you know, which is turned up in another direction. The blue room here at the bottom was the drawing room. The parlor here to the left of it. Then what's the state dining room was to be the state dining room was his... office, and then the entrance hall. In the entrance hall, he set up a museum of Indian artifacts from the West, especially after Lewis and Clark came back. In fact, when Zebulon Pike came back, he brought two little bears who were put in there. And so it was always, he encouraged the public. He opened the house in 1801, April, and it's been open to the public except in wartime since. East Room still unfinished. You might be interested to know in the bottom of the picture, in the East Room over here, Meriwether Lewis lived there. He was Jefferson's secretary, but he didn't do much but go to dances and study while he was in Washington. And they built two rooms for him with sailcloth. And he was an outdoorsman, you know, and he lived in there with his hunting dogs. And he would go out hunting on Pennsylvania Avenue and shoulder a deer and bring him back, put it in the kitchen, which was below this entrance hall, and it had two huge fireplaces at each end. And they'd clean it, and the family would eat it. Jefferson's main dining room was this room here, the green room. You see the oval room, and to the right of it, the green room was his dining room, or breakfast room. And he, thank you. You'd like to be a fly on the wall. So everyone says Jefferson, he had a round table so everyone would be equal, but of course he did all the talking, so nobody got to talk much. But he dined there with people like Thomas Paine, the author of Common Sense, and all the great patriots, and people like that came there to see him. He was quite an entertainer and quite a politician, and his politics were done at the dinner table. He had the best food in Washington, and he invited people rather specifically for specific purposes to get things done politically. Jefferson made the first grounds plan, which was actually followed.
It's a pointer. Yeah.
Well, next picture. Here's the house. Jefferson also, you're going north there. Jefferson added wings to the house, to each side. Stables were to be here and over here. And then there were office buildings that they connected to for the government. And over here was to be a greenhouse or orangery. Over here was to be an arch of triumph. See, there's a drop of 14 feet between the north lawn and the south lawn. And so the house snuggles up against it, and the basement floor, or they call the ground floor today, noses up to the ground over here in an areaway. But it's completely open down here and ground level. So because Washington changed the size of the house, it didn't fit in those avenues anymore. And the commissioners worried, what in the world, where are we going to site this house? Are you going to be able to see it from one avenue or the other or what? So Washington, being a surveyor, came in, literally took off his coat and staked the White House. He put the stakes in the ground for where it went. Well, it knocked it out of this view from Pennsylvania Avenue entirely. You didn't see it at all. So to compensate for that, Jefferson built an Arch of Triumph, which we'll see in a minute, and then the driveway came here and under that arch and up to the front. This was considered the private area, and this was the public area. So you went under this arch to get to the front. This was actually put in, and this garden was actually planted and existed with only one photograph ever taken of it by accident. in 1856. So it was there. After Thomas Jefferson, of course, was James Madison. And at the time, Jefferson was considered a recluse at the end of his term. Madison was considered a man of the people, but he was a withered little tiny guy that was very shrewd politically and very, very smart. The front office was handled by his wife, Dolly Madison, one of the famous ladies of the White House. And she rather defined White House entertaining and first ladyship early on at that time. She had the house refurnished, the staterooms refurnished, just for entertaining. Here's the furniture as designed by Benjamin Henry Latrobe with the federal shield on it, which was designed by L'Enfant, and the wreath, and all of this painted furniture done over in Baltimore. And it was actually made and put in there. And there were three rooms, the dining room, the today's red room, which was yellow then, and then the blue room, which were where they entertained. And to bring the politicians in, they had Thursday night entertainments and good food and all that stuff. And it began to rival the taverns that they were usually in. And it was of great political value. Well, in the summer of 1814, in the War of 1812, the British did invade. They defeated Napoleon. And the armies that had followed Wellington in Spain and the Navy came to America. They landed here near Baltimore and came overland to Washington. And the story is very dramatic of Mrs. Madison took the picture down of George Washington and had it taken to safety. And she had the Declaration of Independence and other things in her carriage. And she had her parrot with her. And it was very dramatic, and a storm was coming, and they could see the cannon fire in the distance, and then she fled. And they were having a dinner party for 40, and some of the regrets still survive. People said, no thanks, they wouldn't be coming that night. And the British came in and ate the dinner and while the house was being prepared. And it was Lieutenant Richard Pratt, who was Wellington's fire expert in Spain, who burned the house. They were very ceremonial, being military, and they all stood in a circle around it, having piled up the mattresses and things inside and put lamp oil on them, broken out the windows. And then they stood in a circle and threw flaming javelins through the windows, and it all exploded. And it burned that night until about 1 a.m. when a heavy rain came and stopped it. And this is the house as burned. This picture is very accurate because the reconstruction documents, the papers and orders, everything is documented that you see. And what they were able to save was not a lot. The north front here, that stayed. All of this came down to the basement level, which is there. This all came down. The other end all came down, and the entire south front was saved. And it bears out in the record, it bears out when the stone was cleaned, seeing the stones they reused and the ones that were burned with big licks of black soot on them are still under there and still able to be seen. The place was finished about 1817 for in time for New Year's entertainment in 1818. And there was quite a controversy about it. The Benjamin Henry Latrobe came forward saying he could build a better house. Well, politics being what they are, the president didn't care whether it was a better house. He was making a point. They tried to move the Capitol to Cincinnati. A lot of politicians did. And he said, oh, no, all we have to do is repair the public building. But this is what Latrobe produced. Now, I mentioned Leinster House with all the ante rooms and all this stuff. This all suggests a very high level of class and rank use of this house. Madison, it probably made Madison mad. But it's the same shell done differently inside. Yes, it probably infuriated Madison because he didn't want anything like that. He wanted it to look just like it did, and that's what they did. They didn't change much when they rebuilt it. They added 12 fireplaces because it had been very cold and made some rooms into two rooms, but basically it was the same house as he insisted. And it was opened at New Year's, January the 1st, 1818, and at the same time the big reception was being held upstairs, all the crew was below who had rebuilt it. And we're given crackers, it's the funniest connection, of crackers and rum and whiskey and fish. And that's what they partied on that New Year's to reward them for good work. I keep thinking this is a clicker. Here's a view of the house after it was rebuilt. with the house in the middle. And I wanted to call your attention to these buildings. Before the fire, there was one on each side. And they housed the State Department here, the Treasury here, Post Office here, and the War Department, or Navy Department. And they four were built after the fire and put in. And here, there's a fence with the gates that were put in 1818 and such as that. And these buildings stood till the Civil War. They served through the Civil War. But the originals were burned the day after, the morning after the White House was burned. The British came back and burned them. And so they were reconstructed. James Monroe, read in a newspaper, they called his time, he was on one of those tours, the era of good feeling, and he loved it. So he adopted that as the name of his time of his administration. That was his line, like the Great Frontier or whatever, New Deal. It was the era of good feelings. And he set aside to make a very grand White House. He thought there were no more political parties. So he ordered from France a lot of very fine things, and everything I'm going to show you is still in use in the house today, including many other things. Here's the furniture from Paris. Napoleon, of course, had fallen, and it's against the law to display eagles or anything military like that. So this furniture was bought very cheap. You know, the idea here is cannons inverted and all that. So they got that pretty cheap and got it in gold when he had wanted to have it mahogany. There's the Great Plateau. You're only seeing it here about 8 feet long. It's 13 and a half feet long when it's stretched the whole way. Two very fine clocks, the Hannibal clock, next, the Hannibal clock, and then the Minerva clock is another one. These used to be under heavy glass shades or domes, and they ticked away. But today they're in the different living parlors of the house, and they the chimes have been removed. And so in case the president is speaking with someone or making a little talk, he won't be interrupted by clock chimes. So no clocks in the White House chime. There must be 100 old clocks, and they've all had the chimes silenced, wrapped. It was James Monroe who built the South Portico. It's not a portico, in fact. It should have, if it had a triangular pediment, it would be a portico. It's not. It's a porch, but anyway. And, of course, it didn't have a balcony originally. And this was finished in 1824. But you get an idea of the setting of the place. Jefferson built this wall, and it was pretty rustic. Here's some of the workmen's cottages from the stonecutters still there, and so on. And you get the idea of somewhat of what it was like. There's the South Portico as built without this balcony that President Truman added. The house looked just like that when Monroe finished it in 1824. The North Portico was built in anticipation of Andrew Jackson's coming to the White House in his revolutionary election in 1828. And this is a most interesting picture to have turned up. James Hoban was a very old man at the time, and his drawings of the White House were hung on the walls in his house under frames. Charles Bullfinch, the government architect, went there and did tracings, and that's what all that remains, because Hoban died not long after, and the house burned down and everything was lost in it. But Hoban did live to build the North Portico, and this is one of his drawings. The portico is still in the old idiom of stonework of the 18th century. All this is stone. All this, which you would normally think would be wood, all this is carved stone. They had to change the kind of stone. The Quaya Quarry no longer had good stone, and they had to go upriver to Seneca, which is very confusing to me because the Smithsonian building is Seneca stone, and it's kind of pink and rosy color. Well, it wasn't, though, till the 1820s. So it was originally, Seneca stone was this lighter color, but it's still not the same. You see it here stripped of all of its paint and what it was like. You see how weak it is with all those iron things in it.
When was the paint stripped?
Beginning in the Carter administration, and it took about almost 15 years to do. Yeah. It took a long time. Here's the finished North Portico. as it is. It's never changed. It's the same one that was built, finished in 1832. I mentioned Jefferson's Gate. Here's his Arch of Triumph. It was a big deal in the 19th century. This is what you saw when you came down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Capitol. It was huge. It was big, made out of stone and brick. And they planted a willow tree on each side. And the presidents used to come down Pennsylvania Avenue and enter on the north side. And as they were entering, the old president's things were being hauled out this. And they used to say that the president came in the north side rejoicing and left through the gate by the weeping willows weeping. And they were cut down, old, old diseased trees cut down in 1859 when the expansion of the Treasury Building took place. Right about where the south portico of the Treasury Building is where that was. Andrew Jackson's election was a two-fisted thing. Here you see a cartoon that was very popular at the time of all tarnation coming to the White House. His inauguration was legendary. Although it isn't very much so in the books. Nothing was damaged, nothing had to be repaired, but their crowds were so enormous, it came to the White House, that to get him, Jackson was pressed against a blue room wall, and he was so old and weak. He wasn't all that old, but he was weak, and they had to lift him and take him out and take him to a hotel. He couldn't stay, and the crowds didn't even know he was gone, and they were all over the house, and to get him out, the steward took wash tubs and put whiskey and orange juice in them and put them out on the back lawn, and everybody went out to get that and got out of the house. They were pretty rustic, I think. But Jackson's election was two things. It left an impression that the common man had elected him, because it wasn't really true statistically at all. It was William Henry Harrison's that was the common man election in 1840. But really, it was Jackson's election began the removal of the financial center of the United States from Philadelphia to New York, because he would kill the Bank of the United States. It was the stabilizing factor of the economy. And the New Yorkers would take over, and then all the banks, you remember from history class, all the banks, anybody could found a bank that had two pieces of paper and print some money, and finally it all came to a no good end. But Jackson was out by that time, so he never got blamed for it. It was under Jackson that the White House was first completed, 1833. He really spent money on the White House, lots. The grounds were all done, the formal gardens, the vegetable gardens, the inside, it had running water, it had all manner of conveniences that it had never had or never known before. And that was 33, and you see this view of it, this rather idyllic view of it at the time. And it really came into its own then. He bought a lot of things for the house, furnishings. Here's one of the things that survives that was his. A compote for fruit basket from the dining room. And see, so many of these things are still at the White House that they've just used or kept in storage all these years. And now it's under curator and it's cared for. It never was, particularly before the Kennedy administration, although interest in that had started in the 20s. It was Van Buren who added central heating. Now, there had been central heating in the White House under Madison, but just a few rooms. This was a heating system. And it meant that they had to put glass between the columns in the entrance hall to keep the drafts down. That would later be filled with colored glass by Tiffany and the famous glass, Victorian glass screen. Dolly Madison, still by the 1840s, was a fixture at the White House as an old lady. President Polk liked to identify himself with the founding fathers, and she was one of the reasons, and she was the grand old gal, and she was on very hard times, and she lived across the street from the White House, and they would send a coach and six horses to her house across the street, and she would get in it and come in style to entertainments at the White House under the Polks. She died shortly after that. Of course, another great event, the first president's death was in 1841. President William Henry Harrison died after 30 days in office. They say his inaugural address was so long that he got pneumonia, that he got sick. There's a funny description of him showing how modern they were getting. Going to church, he had a cape on with an advertisement printed on the back, gloves with a glove advertisement on it, and a hat with a hatter's advertisement on it. He was good, but very good-natured. looking from the north at the White House. This is one of the first photographs of it as it was. And you can see it's the same house, the same fence, as a matter of fact. It's not the same fence. The fence has been replaced in steel by the Secret Service, but it there you have it. Polk, again, identifying with the Founding Fathers, built this statue on the front of Thomas Jefferson, which is now in Statuary Hall. But it was there from 1848 to 73. Mrs. Polk was quite a character, and Polk wanted to identify with Jefferson for his conquest of California and New Mexico, and she preferred that it be Cortez, so she hung Cortez's picture in the Blue Room at the time. The White House had attached to it a greenhouse beginning in 1856 that became vast. It became huge, rambling all over the place. And it was a wonderful world under glass for the president because it was complete privacy. You could go there on this snowy day and there was sun and it was nice and they all loved it. And it was survived till 1902 when symbolic architecture managed to overdo it and ruin it. And they tore it down. This is an ideal view of the house right on the eve of the Civil War. So you see the greenhouse over here, and the president's office was up here, and the living quarters were here, and these were all the state rooms, the East Room, the Green Room, the Blue Room, the Red Room, and the dining room. And Jefferson's wing had been cut off here and was still under this greenhouse. This is a view today, looking from the middle window in the North Portico. And I brought it to make the point about security. Security has always been an issue at the White House. It's almost bigger than the White House today. But as early as James Monroe's time, he had sharpshooters on the roof behind those balustrades, ready to shoot anybody who came near the place. And by 1854, Franklin Pierce's guards created a little hallway upstairs that went to this window that looked down, because the president would be called out by serenaders to make a talk, and he would go out and on the front, and it was never protected. Well, they decided he couldn't do that anymore. So the president would make his speech from this window, and they would put candles all around the window, and then there would be two men standing behind him, and if there was any kind of a disturbance, he was pulled to the floor. Never happened. But he was pulled to the floor. They were afraid of exposure. And when they had the receptions, which sometimes 6,000 people attended, it was packed. There were plainclothes men with guns. All of the men, doorkeepers, so-called, at the White House were armed. There was always a fear of it. It was not as technologically advanced as it is today. The White House was the stage of Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War. Here you have the very beginning of the war when Cassius Clay of Kentucky had his volunteers all lined up outside. Lincoln is supposed to be standing on the porch somewhere, but it's too dim a picture. But Clay was a kind of a wild old man, and he had one of the first volunteer companies. You see the portico again here is, there's no balcony at that time. Lincoln's era is, in a sense, immortalized the White House. I don't think the White House would still exist if Lincoln hadn't lived there, but he kind of sanctified it. Among the events of the Civil War were the grand receptions. This reception probably represents General Grant's triumphal return from Mississippi and the fall of Vicksburg, because Grant is in the picture. That particular evening, the people came in as usual through the north door in the Blue Room receiving line. Lincoln's hands would be black and blue by the time it was over. The First Lady would always hold it. They didn't call her that then, but hold a bouquet in front of her so she didn't have to shake hands. And then a certain time came, they simply closed the front door, said, "You didn't make it, buddy," and locked it. And then they would clear in the East Room, which was, I mean, packed. They would clear an oval and had what they called the horse show. And the honored guests and the president and his wife would march for about 15 minutes around that circle. So everybody could see the women's dresses. They wore court trains, which is 4 feet from the shoulder to the tip. And they would march all around. And then at the end of it, the honored guests, the president and his wife would stand under the middle chandelier, as you see here, and certain people would be brought up by advanced agreement to meet. At this event, when Yankee Doodle then would play and the president's wife would leave, and then chaos broke loose with all those people in no order of anything. They kept their coats and things in the entrance hall. General Grant had to be saved like Jackson did. He was a little man, you know, and he had to be, he would have been crushed there. So people picked him up and put him on a sofa, and he smiled at everybody from the top of the sofa. And he was idolized in America from that moment on. In that same room, Lincoln's coffin was brought in April of 1865, after his assassination in middle April. And this is the artist's sketch of the catafalque that he had, but it's in error, like newspapers sometimes are, Mara. It shows Mrs. Lincoln. She didn't go. She was the most incompetent first lady. Really. And she stayed in bed for 30 days and screamed. So, anyway, but this is all was done in black and white. And you know what's weird about it in the records? The thing was built by carpenters and people working on the extension of the Treasury Building. Lincoln's body was brought in there in the coffin, and all that was built while he was there. There they were. And they put bleachers up to stand on, but narrow, like shallow steps, and for 3,000 people they packed in that room for the funeral. People would faint, and they'd just be held up by the people on each side of them. And the sickening smell of the flowers was everywhere, and the preacher went on and on and on. I'm surprised they didn't shoot him. But it was a crazy thing that happened. No one could believe it. It was happened by the equivalent of today of some great movie star would shoot the president. You know, it was a mad event, and particularly right in the shadows, right after the surrender at Appomattox and the end of the Civil War. Most soldiers hadn't even gotten home yet, and this thing happened. Well, I'm just going to deal with the Victorian period, kind of a little tour of the house. Here's the Blue Room in about 1870, as done by the Grants. Mrs. Grant was a woman who had lived with a drunk for many years, and a son of a mule skinner, and he happened to be brilliant. He'd gone to West Point, but he just couldn't make it, and they couldn't live on a military salary. And so when the time came and glory arrived, she was the first one in line to take full advantage of it. And no woman ever enjoyed the White House like Mrs. Grant. They practically had to drag her out in chains. And she was furious with him because he wouldn't run for a third term. He would have been elected in a minute. And she tells in her memoir how she just couldn't bear to speak to the successors, the Hayeses. She just couldn't do it. And when she got in the train car to go to New York, she fell on the seat and screamed and cried the whole way. She even told that on herself. But this is the sort of decor of the period. People wanted peace, they wanted an ideal family, and they got that in the Grants. And if it was in doubt, the Grants had a big painting done of themselves that looked like an ideal family and hung in the Red Room. And they redid the house just like you would have done it had you been a banker or a wealthy farmer from Illinois or somewhere. It wasn't done anymore in a really palatial way. It was more steamboaty and things you bought at the store rather than custom-made furniture and things like that.
And not from abroad?
No, nothing. Absolutely. The only thing that came from abroad in those days was China, and that was a racket. 1827, because of a controversy over Monroe's furniture, see, Monroe had this deal where he would sell his furniture to the government when he needed money, and then he'd buy it back when he got paid. And he didn't see anything wrong with that, but there was some objection to it. And they made a law in 1826, that no foreign items could be bought for the White House unless there was something that could not be acquired in America. Well, you've all heard of probably Limoges, China. Well, it's made in Limoges, but most of it was by American companies. There were many China factories there. But American manufacturers could get it cheaper there than making it in the United States. So that's how you always had Limoges, China, and that was from France. Mm-hmm. But no, they were pretty strict. They went to the furniture store for all this stuff. Uh-huh. It wasn't, and that's what they wanted. It was a middling, successful look. Nothing's ever done by accident at the White House. Is that the green room? Yeah. This table, no, wrong one. I'll tell you about another one. But this is, you know, like in a parlor, the gas lights.
What year?
This is about 1876, around in there. All this flocked paper and the ceilings have been painted. And it's really done. I'm there, James Monroe, looking at it. And there was a ventilating system put in. I'd hoped I could see. Yes, that's what this is. Strangest thing. It's those. You turned a crank down here, and it used the flues of the chimney to move air through the house. No substitute for air conditioning, although air conditioning was discovered and invented at the White House. Grant took the grand staircase down and created the West Hall on the second floor, which you've seen many pictures of. The family uses that for a sitting room. For some reason, they've always loved that area. They have the setting sun, and it's real nice. There's a big archway right out of the picture this way. And from then on and now, certainly, there's no stair there now anymore. It was a favorite place for the family and is to be. Is the dining room set for dinner in 1881 with those little chairs bought by the Polks and the plateau, the great plateau of James Monroe. Now, Mrs. Grant couldn't stand it. She put copper screen wire on it at one point and stuck flowers on it, and she didn't like it at all. And finally, she went to the centennial of 1876, and there she found a centerpiece that was silver that showed Hiawatha going down the Gitche-Gumee, rowing his boat, and that's what she liked, and she used that. But everyone since has thought it was horrible and kind of hides the thing. But Miss Grant was her own gal. Here is the blue room decorated for Grover Cleveland's wedding. He married a woman 22 years younger than he was when he was in the White House, and she was the first White House celebrity, Frances, called Frankie. And they married in the blue room. And the flowers all had symbolic meaning with the Victorians. The hearth was on this side of the room, and it had red salvia to symbolize the fire of love. The centerpiece in the dining room had a temple of Hymen to symbolize chastity of the bride. Imagine. And then all of these plants had certain meanings that the gardener turned up when decorating the place. I don't know how he forgot about that. But anyway, see the glass screen? That's been put in already by the time of Grover Cleveland. Cleveland was a Democrat, the first one since 1860, and he was got us involved in international affairs in a way that we had not been before. President McKinley redecorated the room in 1898, and this is the way it looked during the Spanish-American War. And they were very bellicose. They had a party there and invited the Spanish minister and took chicken wire and hung it down from the ceiling here and put put foliage in it and then dangled red, white, and blue light bulbs down in the middle of the thing and had a cannon in the room. He must have felt very welcome at the time. The White House was awfully small. The offices upstairs, there were only 7 rooms for the family, and because it was always open to the public, they didn't use the downstairs very much. And so to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the presidency in 1889, Mrs. Harrison and the Corps of Army Engineers decided to remodel and expand. And it nearly happened. Here's the house, the old house. They added these little wings and then round wings and then these long, huge wings. Oh, you know, the typical thing today, art galleries and offices and stuff. This would have been the West Wing. There were guest rings, and then because of the difference between the height of the grade here and back there, the greenhouses went across and you could see right over them. Well, this nearly happened, but Harrison, unfortunately, appointed a postmaster in Maine, and Tom Reed, who was Speaker of the House, was a real tyrant, and he was from Maine, and he wanted to appoint the postmaster, so he just saw that Leland Stanford didn't get this bill through. It was the Stanford bill. So it didn't happen. A decade later, a similar plan, maybe a little better thought out, was done for President McKinley. And they had a big showing of it and of this model. And Poor Mrs. McKinley was like a little bird in a wheelchair, and they were wheeling around. She said, "It's all very nice, but there's not going to be any hammering while I live here." So that wasn't too encouraging either. Well, it all got in a dogfight between the American Institute of Architects and the Corps of Army Engineers, who aren't buddies anyway. And one represented the government, of course, and one represented private practice. And so they had been at it in the 90s, and the Corps of Army Engineers won. When Theodore Roosevelt came in, and Mrs. Roosevelt's cousin, Edith Wharton, later the novelist, by then she was a critic of architecture, buildings, and interiors. So the house was remodeled completely in 1902 in 90 days into something very different. You see the beginning in the hall. They've taken the Tiffany glass screen out. It's traceable to a hotel in Annapolis, which burned down in 1920. So there's probably nothing left of it. It made Tiffany famous, and he began making his lampshades and all, and where he really became, you know, his father had the big jewelry store in New York, which got big by making medals in the Civil War for the soldiers. That's where Tiffany's money, that's where the basis came from, and then they went into jewelry and so forth. So the son really did a lot, and this made him famous. Here's the state dining room as was finished in that remodeling. I'd like to tell you that Roosevelt shot all these, and he didn't deny it, but he didn't. They were bought from a decorator named William Hart in New York. But the oak paneling is to make, an entire changed image for the White House, changing it from the dowdy old house of the local banker or something to the House of State. Because after the war in 98, the United States emerged on the world scene, and they wanted a world-class White House. And at the same time, we're planning a revival of L'Enfant's plan for the city. And it led to what you see today on the Mall and Massachusetts Avenue, those houses and everything. And the White House was the opening gun. The grand staircase was removed when they took the space into the dining room. And this grand staircase was a result. That's a later picture. But it was tailored to Roosevelt's entrance ceremony. He wanted to be very presidential. And so, Hail to the Chief, which started under Jackson and Polk, Roosevelt would play, the two trumpet players would come here and blast, and then they'd back up and roll those gates into the wall, and then Hail to the Chief would begin, and the president would come down standing alone, and then two by two, some 30 guests would come down, the women with their trains over their arms, and playing Hail to the Chief, and he would march down the stairs. Very, very brilliant ceremony that stair was designed for.
Would they do that for every kind of every reception?
Everything. He loved any of that, mm-hmm. any kind of glory, and mm-hmm. you know, and also with the presidency, it was a new presidency, and if McKinley created it, Roosevelt dramatized it so beautifully, and he defied the world. I mean, he's the one that began to call the crown heads of Europe by their first names, and I'm sure he would have called Victoria Victoria. Because he felt that he was head of state. There was always that little problem of the sovereign. Who is the sovereign? Well, it was the queen in England and so forth in Austria. And here, there's the people. So there's a little diplomatic problem of definition there. The green room is really high-style design for that time. That would have pleased Edith Wharton immensely. It was done up in chintz and in velvet. And most of that furniture is still in storage, but it's not used anymore. Roosevelt's study upstairs in the Oval Room was using the desk that President Kennedy and many others were later to use. Next. An old nasty hallway downstairs with this beautiful vaulting in it, old greasy hallway with the kitchen on one side, was and store meat rooms and everything else, was taken over as a ground floor. And plastered white, and then you then did not enter the house as you had always entered it. You entered it through a new east wing, which they rebuilt. Jefferson's had long since been torn down. And this is an open porch or loggia that the cars drove up here, the carriages. And because the cars really weren't a big issue here until toward the end of Roosevelt. Then you went in here, down a long corridor that was open like this, with storm windows put in finally, and they never took them out. And then you went in that basement and up into the house. So it gave the opportunity, without changing the state floor, to put bathrooms and things in the in code rooms in the basement. And today's movie is the same thing when you go today, except it's been extended. This has been brought out much farther to the street. The White House image under Roosevelt was renewed as something else that has prevailed. It could have gone, but it didn't. The public saved the White House, really. And then it was a matter of what to do with it. And Roosevelt and Charles McKim, the architect, it was honed down to an understandable look. It would go through many more changes. I'm going to show you a lot of the Truman changes, but in the 1930s, got interested in, in the 20s, really, in period antiques in the rooms. And here you see the first period room in the White House. This is the Green Room. And it was done and finished in 1932. This is a chandelier from a castle. All these are copies. And it had a very enthusiastic committee working on it. And committees are not entirely popular at the White House for doing this sort of thing, but that's how they get the money. And they really it grates on them what these people sometimes say to the public. And they don't do that so much anymore, but in those days they did. Calvin Coolidge kicked them out of the house. But what's funny with me about it is most all that furniture is copied from different committee members' own possessions they had in their house. They just wanted to have that in the White House. The Monroe Room was another room that was created by Mrs. Herbert Hoover. It was above that room, and it had antiques and things in it. She liked real antiques. She didn't like copies of things like in the Green Room, and they were quite at odds over it. The house had become structurally very unsound by the 1940s, after the war, and the Roosevelts moved out 16 van loads of furniture, and it was big, lanky rooms and cracked plaster, and it could have been saved probably, but the 90-day wonder in 1902 with Theodore Roosevelt had done some very quick things that hurt the structure a lot. So that, together with the terror of the Secret Service, of a kamikaze style attack, an airplane crashing into the house, or a firebomb, if anyone carried it in. It could have blown it up. It was mostly wood, and all that wood left. Led Truman to agree to a rebuilding of the White House. It's very unusual because most presidents are not going to be interrupted that much with that much going on. They've got to have it. So they undertook it from 1948 to 52, and here's what they did. Truman insisted that the original stone walls that George Washington had watched go up remain. And we don't have this thing. Here's your original house. There were 4 feet of brick inside that, behind those stones. See, the stones were just on the outside, as they were in most English houses, European houses. The pretty stuff was outside and then rubble on the back. They pulled all that away and they built this steel frame inside and went way down under the original pilings, way down into two basements. You remember when 9/11, when Vice President Cheney was in this basement at the White House. Here's where he was, down here. And they put new footings under here and recreated the house from that, leaving the old stone shell. Demolition began by the taking down of the paneling and all of that sort of thing, packing it away. Not very much of it was reused, as it turned out, because they got in a hurry. By 52, Truman was getting ready to leave office, and they just got in a big hurry. And most of the White House went to landfill at Fort Myer. Here you have them tearing into the place. The old wooden beams still there. Most of that was saved and made into paneling. And where they had, in McKim's time, they simply furred out the walls with those strips and put new walls in, a canvas and matted the silk and things on it that they used. Here's some of the old brick from 1818. Original flooring coming up. It's interesting what they had there. They had these things. They've been turned sideways in the process of getting them out. They made a floor beneath the floor about that far. And it was all filled with cedar shavings, packed as tight as you could pack, for bugs and insulation. And it was all powdered by the time they got into it this time. But it's the only way we can study the structure of the White House now is these pictures. And we have hundreds of them. Here you have the steel frame coming in. What they did was, and I'll show you, there's a better picture to show it with. See, in this case, none of the wood was left. Here are the old sockets that used to receive the wooden pieces. Well, it's all going to be steel now. Each room is a cage of steel and concrete block. And the idea being if a bomb blew up in it, it would just blow up in that room. Here's the back. I want you to notice these chutes coming down. And that's how you got up to work on the roof. Now, it's just the construction. I mean, they're trying to preserve all this. In fact, they were taking a dump truck in. They were going to take a dump truck in, and they were chopping out one of the doors about to, and President Truman saw them and said, "Stop, you can't do that." I said, "These walls are never to be touched." So they had to take the dump truck down and the bulldozer down to these pieces, bring them in, build them again, and dig the basements and cellars, and then they went out under the walls. So here's the site. Here's the old grand staircase. It's been torn out with the niches on it. This is here under the east room now. Now, what you see here is very interesting. What they did was, to empty the house and to support it, the house had a third floor that had been built of concrete and steel in the 1920s. It was extremely heavy. It was just mashing down on it like a hamburger. And so what they did was they went inside and they created four channels like elevator shafts. Here's one of them. Heavy steel. They went clear to the bottom beneath where the new basements would be and clear up like table legs to that top floor, which they retained. And then they gutted the house through those shafts, pulling it up to the second floor and out those chutes. And that way they emptied the entire vessel and just left it a big vacant thing inside. And if you go there today and go in those the cross hall or the transverse hall on the main floor that all the parlors and everything open off of, on each side of you are those same towers they built because they stayed on as part of the structure, this that you see on the screen. So it was an engineering feat. They did a little experiment in advance at Yale with one of the old buildings. Here's one of the rebuilt rooms. The house was air-conditioned for the first time. It had never been air-conditioned. The West Wing, they tried in 1913 to air-condition it by blowing air over ice. It didn't work. Roosevelt had horrible asthma, and most of his staff, and many lived in the White House. So they stuck air-conditioning units on top of the chimneys. And it blew soot in all the rooms, but at least they could breathe. The house was entirely air-conditioned and done in what were called at the time air-conditioning colors. This is the blue room, the bluest of blues. There's the grand stair. That was a bone of contention with President Truman. He didn't like that to enter with that long stair and hail to the chief. He thought he looked awkward. You know, he was a real clothes horse. He loved clothes. And he liked to look great. And he said, looking up at you made you look foolish. And so they did project after project trying to please him with the right kind of stair. And finally they came up with this, which you know. It's a photo op stair, really. They play hail to the chief and come down the stair, and then they all stand there. And the press is allowed to flash, 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 flash. And then they leave, and the party goes on. And that was a result of the Truman renovation. This picture gives you an idea of the difference between this White House and the one before. This White House is more like a public building, more marble, more of that sort of thing than the White House had in the old days. In the old days, it had wooden floors in the early days, and then McKim put stone in. The East Room, somewhat as it had been, the same chandeliers that McKim had put in there, and the Washington portrait on the wall, and then a copy made by Professor Andrews in the 1880s of Martha Washington. They took her head, and she was in her 50s, and they put it on the body of the president's 18-year-old niece. So it's a very funny looking thing with a little chair beside it. It was Truman who invented the Lincoln bedroom. And there's the decorator's study for it, watercolor. It's just been changed, but it was never the Lincoln bedroom before that. That was Lincoln's office. It was the Lincoln study and various things like that. And this is where they supposedly see a lot of ghosts. And they returned to the house, put all the things back, And as time has passed, beginning in a strain that started in the 20s, the whole interest in putting antiques in the house and creating rooms that really are photographic images has come to be. Here you see what you saw as Teddy Roosevelt's office, and was FDR's office as well, is now the yellow oval room upstairs, a formal drawing room where you have cocktails before a state dinner, and it boils out into the central hallway upstairs, and then they all go down the stairs to hail to the chief. The house is full of tradition. Here are the old Jackson magnolias, maybe, planted by Jackson. I think they at least came from Tennessee, but I think they were put in probably by Rutherford B. Hayes. But anyway, they're ancient trees, and everybody thinks they're going to die every year, and they come back and bloom in June, just covered with bloom. In 1951, they were believed to be dying, and they were too close to the house. They were moving out this way. So in January, during a hard freeze, they dug a V-shaped 25-foot channel that inclined down. They dug the tree out, this ancient tree, shot it with hoses and froze the roots, slid it down in that channel and replanted it, and it bloomed in June. So they've been moved, those huge trees. Yeah. Now today they have a machine that just goes in and takes the tree doesn't even know it was moved. So the magnolia, as long as it's there, here we go. The north facade is unchanged. If George Washington came here, he wouldn't recognize the portico, but he would recognize everything else about the White House. And the complex today is includes the house in the middle, as it always was, 1824, over here, 1832, 2932. Here's the Treasury Building. That was built in the 1850s, begun in the 1830s because the original burned. And over here, the State War and Navy Building to accommodate all three of those departments in one building came in the 1870s. And then here's the West Wing. The West Wing was first built in 1902, doubled in size in 1909, which included the building of the first Oval Office, and then enlarged again in 1934 by Franklin D. Roosevelt with another Oval Office, the one that's there now, with the ceiling decorations from Monticello. This is it, and it's the way it functions today. The greatest threat to it today is the security threat. It is in many ways outlived its time, but it's very unlikely that any president is going to move out of it, because as President Taft once said, his wife used to handle everything of a social and official nature, and she had a stroke, and he had to handle guest lists and things. And he looked up one time and said, "This White House is a very useful place," because he could place people. And the importance of going there, even the Oval Office was never used for a bill signing until Woodrow Wilson. No one would do that. They'd go into the House to sign it. It has a certain magic in American history, and I think it's a given that the president will never move out, but it'll be interesting to see how he will be protected, because more and more the removal of vehicular traffic from the area, and that's only begun. They're not going to let cars go any nearer, and it will be interesting for all of us to watch and see how it's preserved, because it certainly will be, I'm certain. Is there any question?
I have a question right here. Is that the area of the colonnade that Jefferson created?
There's only one left that Jefferson created, and that's the one this way, for the West Wing.
It's on the other side of the briefing room?
Other side, over. You mean this, the swimming pool was.
Yeah.
This was Jefferson's, and it was enlarged by Monroe to come out to where the Oval Office is now as a stable, which didn't work out. It was too close to the house. But over this wing, where the arch was to have been, was torn down after the Civil War and rebuilt by Theodore Roosevelt as a new entrance.
I see.
But you see how big that entrance has become.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it was just a little thing, and then FDR wanted it, and he wanted a museum of the White House, but it never became a museum. It was built during the war and only partially finished with the bomb shelter, the best kept secret in the country, built under it. Roosevelt went in at once and said, "Get me out of here," because it was very grim. Now they store chairs in it for big events and the tent. Yeah, so it's just, it's grown and grown and grown where it is. And in the Kennedy administration, so much interest was shown in it, because Lafayette Park over here if you're talking about the architecture, you say Lafayette Square. If you're talking about the green part, it's Lafayette Park. As of a law passed in 1928, there were going to be high-rise buildings all around that. And the plan was there, the money was there, and the Kennedy administration managed to turn that around. And that's why those houses have been restored and replicated, some of them, all along Lafayette Park Square, so it will give a residential context to the White House again that's lost. And of course, all that is now under the Secret Service. There's no, you can walk in there, but that's all.
Let's take a few questions. Towson, do you want to start us off?
Pick up, please.
Anybody got a question?
Yes, I have a question. You keep talking about how the White House is just growing and growing and growing and expanding depending on the era and the administration. How do you feel that it will handle growth in the future, and how do you feel like the physical structure of the White House will change to accommodate growth? I mean, will they go down? Will they build up? Will they continue to build more structures on the ground? What will happen, do you feel?
I think it'll be auxiliary buildings, and it'll be just a continual reevaluation of the pecking order. The West Wing, it would be maddening to do a history of, because partitions are moved all the time there, even during administrations. And I think it'll just be hard, fast decisions on how many the West Wing will take. They will be first in line. Then Warren Navy Building, or the Executive Office Building, and then the new Executive Office Buildings on 17th Street. And they're going to be new ones. They'll have to be, or the taking over of other buildings in the area. I don't think in the grounds, however, there's going to be anything. They've talked about going underground, under the ellipse, beyond the south of the White House grounds, and putting parking and such under there. And it could be they'll one day do offices out there, but I tend to doubt it. I do.
What do you think about the Park Service plan to put the press office underneath the North Lawn? Remember in 98 they came up with a plan?
Well, it's one way. You mean to get them off of Pebble Beach?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they are all outside.
Also, and the offices that there, or the desk space that there is now is pretty...
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Well,
needs a little dusting.
They don't want to go into the North Lawn, of course. It's that will have to have relief, and I imagine the press is going to be pushed away, or fewer people will be allowed in there, because they allow a lot.
Yeah.
So I would think that's where that will go.
Mm-hmm.
Truman wanted to take the West Wing and run it down 17th Street south to the big building, and it didn't get through Congress. The money didn't.
He also had an idea of having a theater for press conferences.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that I think they will do everything they can to preserve the scale of the building as it is. It's already been infringed upon a lot. And I would think there will be other buildings in the neighborhood they'll simply take over as it grows.
Another question?
Yeah. You mentioned that Lincoln's era immortalized the White House. Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, the Lincoln family sort of sprang on the United States. Those around him believed he was brilliant, but it wasn't universal. In fact, he wasn't really called great till the late 1880s, early 90s. But the melodrama of his family was known by everybody more than any other family situation in the history of the place. They had come there from a Midwest town. Now, he was no slouch. I mean, he was a very, very well-known and very prosperous trial lawyer. But he came there, and they lost a child. One of the children died. They had already lost one. All manner of tragedy befell the family. Her sister's husband was killed in the Battle of Atlanta, and the sister came up, and everybody yells, you know, rebels in the White House. And Mrs. Lincoln herself was accused frequently of being a spy. And she did. There were spies in the White House. And there's a whole melodrama that everyone followed just with rapt interest. And it all was on that stage. I mean, who'd ever heard of the Lincolns before that? And the White House was the stage of where all that happened. And that's why it seems to me that perpetuated the White House more than anything else. George Washington and the walls had become rather distant. And then, of course, his being killed right at the end of the war. That's another thing.
And I guess the controversy, too, over her her purchasing of furniture.
Well, that was all in the papers at the time, too.
Yeah.
And then she went on and became a very tragic character, sold her clothes, had to be sent to an asylum. And it was a sad, sad family story. And you associate the White, that's where it all happened.
Howson, do you have a question?
Yeah, hold on.
What has the current Bush family done different with the White House?
To change things?
Yeah.
Well, the usual redecoration. The Oval Office gets redecorated because it's become a TV background for the president. And so it's always given a personal stamp. And the Lincoln bedroom has been redone. There have been things like that that have been redone in the house. But nothing major comes to mind. They knew the White House a long time before they got there. And have not changed much at all.
Question here?
Very seldom is the White House changed because of personal caprice. It has to do with, you're visiting royalty. It has, usually there is a political something behind it. Even the Kennedy one. It was a stage setting for the Kennedys, a background for them. It was done very quickly, and when the local advisories and all that dragged their feet, they went around them and hired a French designer to come in and do it. And it was a background setting for the presidency, which is happens in state houses. That's what they're all about. Then every governor's mansion in the country had to be restored.
I wanted to know about the history of Blair House. I was yelled at and interrogated by the Secret Service the other day because I tried to take a picture of Yushchenko in front of the Blair House,
oh,
the
really?
President of Ukraine. And I'm wondering why they made the decision to put visiting dignitaries there.
Well, that was a Franklin Roosevelt decision. Blair House had been emptied in the Lee House next door from the 1850s, and the Blair House, 30s. Anyway, they had been emptied and were to be demolished because of that 1928 law. And President Roosevelt's condition physically declined terribly, and there were so many people in the White House that worked for him, who he wanted near him because he was handicapped. That he had the house furnished and fixed up for guests. And that's when that started. And it once started, of course, it was there. And then Truman moved into it in 48 while the house was being rebuilt. He lived there till 52, and there was an attempt on his life. You may have seen the plaque out of the man who was killed. And it's recommended itself over and over, and now it's several buildings, goes clear down to the corner, and can take a number of people. And does. Now, people were coming and staying 6 weeks, and going to Disney World and coming back. And President Bush the First was stopped to that. And they're given, I believe, 3 days, or maybe a fourth day, and then they either start paying or get out. So it's the President's guest house. So the White House is not big enough for all that.
Towson, we'll have one last question from each place. Towson?
How do you feel about the change of the amount of visitors that are allowed to come into the White House with as rich as it is in history? What's your view on how you now have to have groups of 10 or more come in to take the tour of the White House?
Well, I'm afraid that's going to continue, and that probably is generous. The Secret Service can't stand that. They don't want that to happen. I mean, it's just one more element, one more complication in the security process. But the house has been open for so long that it means so much to people. But I don't think the great trails of people will ever again happen, just randomly going through. So many things have happened over the years. The blood thrown on the rug in the dining room in the Lyndon Johnson period, the woman, not long ago, in the Clinton administration, who put touch-up paint from your car, scribble it all over a statue in the blue room.
Yeah.
And these things keep happening. And I think there's just going to be that sort of tight control. And I believe the only reason it's shown at all is because of Mrs. Bush. And she has insisted on it. She first made them let school children come in and then began extending it and extending it to what you know today and what you're speaking of. This is one of the hazards of the place.
Last question here. Yes, Roger.
Do you think that the House defines and confines the presidency? And if you had to play alternate historian, do you think the presidency would be considerably different if they had moved out, went somewhere else?
If they had moved out? That's hard to answer. The White House is, the presidency is so, this image of the presidency and the symbolism is so tied in with that house. And now with television, the world over, it's just an icon, an instant icon. Had Theodore Roosevelt moved out and moved to Rock Creek Park, which the Corps of Army Engineers really wanted, to move to a suburban palace? I don't know. It would have had its problems because it would have been remote. It wouldn't have been open like the White House, and as George Washington created it with that open plan and all that. It would have been very different. It would have been like a suburban palace, and which they had in mind. And the public wouldn't have seen it. And it might have impacted it some. Maybe a president would have moved back in. But it's hard to say. They're melded together, and that's why no president's going to leave. The last one who tried was Eisenhower. He wanted to build a high-rise building on the Mall and have the top two floors for the president. I know the Secret Service would love that, or the airport right there. But the public outcry was so great.
When did he think about that?
Right, early on. You see General Lucius Clay and all those people who were in the Waldorf. They had a whole floor here and lived like that. And he thought, wow, that's good living. And so